Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the Fresno mayor's race is heating up. We'll talk with Fresno City Council member and mayoral candidate Lee Brand about things that are going on in his district, as well as the ongoing water crisis facing residents in northeast Fresno, which has residents concerned about potential levels of lead in their water. Of course, we'll also talk politics with Lee and his November general election face-off with Henry Perea. We'll also get an update on what's going on at the Discovery Center, science activities this summer for kids and families. Right now, though, we return to a story we told you about last week, air quality. Of course, a tremendous problem here in the San Joaquin Valley. Our air is consistently ranked the worst in the nation alongside the L.A. area. And for residents, it's been linked to immune problems, emergency room visits, and even premature deaths. Local officials now have put forth a new plan to help clean up the air. It involves federal help. Last week, we heard from the Air District's Syed Said Reddin. This week, we hear why critics are less than thrilled with the district's response. Here's FM 89's Carrie Klein.
If it were winter, you could turn to the east from almost anywhere in the San Joaquin Valley and admire the snowy peaks of the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
So we're standing on Shaw near Fruit in Fresno.
But it's summertime. The Sierra looks different. And Dolores Weller of the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition says it's not just because the snow is melting.
You really cannot see the mountains. They are not visible. On days like this when we have high ozone, high smog, they are completely blocked.
Ozone, smog, particle pollution, they're all endemic to this area.
I think we'd have a view of our beautiful mountains year-round if we implemented some strict measures for our valley. And, it's not just about the view, it's also for, our health.
Strict measures are going to be necessary to clean up our air. But officials haven't really agreed on what those measures should be. Advocates like Weller urge our air district to crack down on pollution from valley businesses. And to a certain extent, it has. Air quality has generally been improving, but federal standards recently got tighter, and Syed Said Reddin of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District says it's time to think bigger.
To really get any meaningful reductions in emissions, we need to reduce pollution from these large source categories, trucks and locomotives. And unfortunately, the only agency that can really do that is the federal EPA.
That's right. He's asking the feds for help. The valley's in a tight spot because it has to make huge reductions in ozone and particle pollution within the next 15 years, or else we face hefty fines, loss of highway funds, and penalties for local businesses. But our pollution isn't entirely our fault. According to the Air District, the majority of the nasty stuff stagnating in valley air comes from diesel trucks and trains, which are under federal jurisdiction. So, the Air District sent the EPA a petition asking it to significantly tighten emission standards for heavy-duty trucks and locomotives.
So if we can reduce that, let's say, by 90% with these measures that we're suggesting, it'll basically cut down our pollution in San Joaquin Valley in half.
The petition is a bold move because the EPA doesn't usually get involved locally. The agency sets national standards for pollutants, then it lets local air districts figure out how to meet them. But Said Reddin argues the valley has done literally all it can.
We've basically put in place all the low-hanging fruit, medium-hanging fruit, high-hanging fruit, and really at this point, there is no way to get there without them doing something.
But is that actually true? Not really, says Anthony Wexler. He's director of the UC Davis Air Quality Research Center. From a scientific perspective, stricter regulations for trucks and trains would make a difference here. But he says it's wrong to claim the valley has done everything it can.
There are also other emissions in the San Joaquin Valley that are related to agriculture. Diesel water pumps, emissions from silage related to dairy operations for feeding cows. And that silage and those pumps are all emitting a lot of pollution also.
Really, he says, the Air District is motivated by more than science. Industries like agriculture and petroleum are powerful, and the pressure they exert is not always in line with health.
And so the staff in the district are stuck between a rock and a hard place. They need to meet these standards. Their board basically won't let them do agricultural emission regulations, and so they're stuck trying to get the feds to reduce something else to help them meet the regulations.
Of the Air District's 15 board members, only two are not county supervisors, mayors, or city council members influenced by local businesses. Here's advocate Dolores Weller again.
It is highly politicized, and some measures that, you know, the Air District staff, you know, could propose would not be the most popular to board members. So unfortunately, that's our political climate.
So would the feds really agree to national sweeping changes in truck and train emission standards? The EPA wouldn't comment on this story, but it's doubtful, which means air officials will have to work harder here at home. And for that, Wexler and Weller are ready with a long list of suggestions. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Fresno mayor's race is heating up this July, and two candidates are squaring off in the November general election. They are front runner in the race, Henry Perret, who came in first in the June primary, followed by Fresno City Council member Lee Brand, who joins us now in our studio today. Lee, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Lee, you racked up a big endorsement last week with number three finisher in the primary, H. Spees, endorsing your campaign and joining on your team. I want to talk to you about that in a little bit, but first, turning to your day job, so to speak, and that's Fresno City Council, this ongoing situation about the water in Northeast Fresno residents' homes. This is something that our station reported on last week, and before that, this has been going on through the media for a while now, that people are finding out that they have water in their homes that is somehow rusty or contaminated in some way. The water that's coming in from the city doesn't have that problem, but somewhere along the line, something's happening. When did you first learn about this problem?
Well, I would say early this year, we started getting a lot of complaints from my office and directly to the city water department about discolored water. And I think what it was, this problem's been around for over 10, 12, 13, 14 years. And I'll tell you what we found out. And so I think social media was, people were connecting the dots and saying there must be, and it's not just an isolated case, it's coming up enough that I asked our office and Tommy Esquita went out aggressively, went out to people, did testing, and he'd go say, can I talk to your neighbor and your neighbor and your neighbor, and did additional testing to the point where we were determining, you know, at least preliminarily it was tied into galvanized pipes and potentially to the Northeast Surface Water Treatment Plant. And so we agreed to have a series of public meetings. We've had two public meetings already. The first public meeting was in April, and I attended that meeting. And at first, I had never been given access to the presentation. I didn't know exactly where they were at this meeting. And Tommy did a great job explaining what the problem was. It was, you know, it was basically galvanized pipe that was corroding after so many years. And there was never a magic marker like at 10 years or 20 years, in some cases 5 years, other cases 30 years. But when it corroded to the interaction with the soil, small holes would get in the pipe, you'd get rust, and you'd get rust, you'd get discolored water, and in some cases you'd get elevated levels of lead. And there was some discussion about, you know, the Northeast plant. When the Northeast plant came in 2004, a lot of people said the problem started then. But there's never been a simple cause and effect. There's an anomaly for everything. So one guy says, yeah, it happened exactly on this date. The guy next door has no problem. So that's part of the complexity. But it's an ongoing thing. And what the surface water that comes from, this is from Millerton and from the San Joaquin River, and we have the well water. And the surface water is more pristine. It doesn't really have the minerals. And having the minerals are inhibitors that, you know, that prevent corrosion. And there's a proper pH level. I'm just getting into the details here, and so the city's still trying to figure out if somehow the mixture between surface water and the well water was causing a problem, and it may have caused a problem. Remember, prior to the surface water treatment plant coming in, because I've been in that district since 1989, it was a period of rapid growth in the 1980s and 1990s in northeast Fresno. And what happened was that there were so many homes and businesses there, water pressure. I remember taking a shower. Come on, get a few drops out. You took a shower between, say, 7 a.m. and 8 a.m., you'd have a slow shower. And it was because the wells were not sufficient. So they built the surface water treatment plant in 2004. When that came online, it solved the problem of pressure, but obviously created other problems.
Lee Brand is with us today talking about the issue of water in northeast Fresno. Some residents there have concerns that their water in their homes may be contaminated by rusty galvanized pipes. And is there a connection with the city's water treatment plant? Lee, the city is right now in this big Recharge Fresno project, building another water treatment plant serving a good portion of the rest of the city. Should this be a concern for other, even older parts of the city that also probably have galvanized pipes in many homes? Is the city doing something to be proactive on that end?
Well, so far, the city has spent $250,000 in its investigation. The city has engaged the State Department of Water Resources, Fresno County Health Department, EPA, other agencies, and private individuals. And at that first meeting I mentioned earlier, that's when I heard for the first time there was a couple. There's apparently two or three that have been receiving bottled water since 2004, 2005. I'm saying, well, how in the hell did that ever happen? And apparently, back then, there were a few incidents that people reported discolored water. In fact, I had a house out there myself, a rental house, that same problem. I was told the problem is your problem. It's from the meter inside. Simply just run the water for a couple of minutes. You solve it. Okay. I was never told to test. Never told there was a bigger problem. I think at that point in time, it was a smaller problem. But the city, in my opinion, failed to act back in 2004, 2005. Had they done what we have done, the right thing, which is to do the exhaustive investigation to determine, hey, there's got to be a correlation between this new surface water treatment plant and something that's going on down there. But the unique problem here is that the same builders used the same galvanized pipes in northwest Fresno and southeast Fresno. Why are these mainly popping up in southeast Fresno? And the only thing different would be it's either the soil conditions and how the galvanized pipe reacts, or it's the chemical way that the water comes from the surface water treatment plant. And I've talked to experts, and they say the soil, not the issue. So that's the only thing we can, at least this point in time, pinpoint. And as we speak now, the city is like in a lab. They're trying to fine-tune what's the right level. They can't overreact because they might have somebody who solved their problem. In many cases, it was simply changing a fixture. Any fixture, plumbing fixture, installed before 2014 has lead. Every single one has lead. So you're going to get traces of lead. In some cases, houses only had one fixture that showed the discolored water. And typically, it was like a back bathroom that nobody ever used because it just built up. In some cases, it was hot water heaters that failed. So there's a lot of things we're looking at. I can say from my point of view, and I'm sure I'm speaking for the administration, this will not be complete till we've found a definite cause, we've found a solution, and that there are no houses in Fresno with discolored water or any houses in Fresno with high levels of lead.
Your opponent in the November election for Fresno Mayor, Henry Perea, is holding a press conference in about 40 minutes about this very issue, an issue that affects your district. We don't know exactly what he's going to say, but he has posted that he's going to solve this problem and take care of it. Your thoughts on Supervisor Perea's weighing into this issue?
Here's an opportunist trying to capitalize on the misfortune of others. A person with 24 years of failed leadership who did nothing during his time on the city council to address this water capital program. It was one of several councils that kicked the can down the road, failed to act, who has his own problems in his own districts with forest contaminated water, who's failed to act. I did the right thing. I took a lead in terms of the water capital program 2 years ago when it wasn't popular to say, gee, I'm going to raise your water rates because we have a major problem in our aquifer. We have a problem back then. We still have contaminated wells in southeast Fresno, which is his supervisor district. He opposed it until the end. He advised a political candidate not to take a stand on this deal. So this is all about opportunism, not about real leadership. And I went even further by introducing a, I'll bring out in about another month, a water rebate program to take, offer help for those people who have to replace fixtures or their supply line, and a low interest rate loan for people who may have more serious problems to address the issue.
Henry also posted, I think it was last week, online, a photo of a water bill and circled the bottom line saying this is the increase. And in fact, there have been increases significantly tied to the new water infrastructure plan the city has underway.
You can take those two documents, the copy of the bill and the raise of 33%, the recent post of a water bottle, and Lee Rand didn't do anything in 8 years, and there's hypocrisy. They're inconsistent. Had he taken action during his tenure, we wouldn't have this problem. When it became obvious there was a critical mass, myself and the city of Fresno and Tommy Escueda tackled this problem head on. This should have been done years ago.
Your predecessor, Jerry Duncan, though, is saying that the city should have known a long time ago that this was going on.
Well, it's funny because there's a public records request by a local media station asking for emails. So once I finished the April meeting, I asked my assistant, Ginger, who was then Jerry's assistant, would you go through old emails and let's see what was going on back then? And so did the city manager. Well, you'll see this shortly. So there are emails that Jerry Duncan knew exactly what was going on, was in contact with the water department, Lon Martin, even it suggested a closed session meeting, and it just sort of died about 2007. So there's no question he and others knew there was a problem back then. My contention is they should have taken it beyond just saying what they told me. The problem's inside the meter. There's no health issue. Just flush the water out. They should have did what we did. Leadership is taking chances, is going out and doing the right thing, and that means spending money, and that's part of the water capital program. The city was overdrafting its water supply. Building a surface water treatment plant addresses that issue. But to do that and to guarantee a safe, reliable water source for years to come, our children and our grandchildren, it takes some political courage to take on these programs. Yes, the rates went up. We still have the lowest rates in California for any city over 100,000. We were also able to secure a $200 million, 1.6% low-interest rate state grant, which saved the city from our original proposal, $204 million. And that $204 million will be passed back to ratepayers in lower rates.
You're talking about tough political decisions. Lee Brand joining us today. And issues that require political capital. The city just passed its new fiscal year budget. One of the big things in that is increasing the city's operating reserve moving forward and for the next few years, increasing that significantly. That is something that there's always that push and pull. When there's extra money available, it's very tempting to devote that to other programs. You were very adamant that you wanted to see that reserve increased. How do you think that plays out, especially given the political climate here right now? This is something that in 2008, when Alan Autry left office, the reserve was supposedly there, but apparently it wasn't entirely so. How does that play into this overall race?
Well, this is about leadership, fiscal management, discipline, courage to take the lead and to do unpopular things. We inherited a pretty bit difficult situation in 2009, and there was not a reserve there. There was, when you're deficit spending $36 million, there's not a reserve. But I'm not looking at the past and looking at the future. During our tenure, we came very close to bankruptcy, and through, in many cases, the fiscal policies that I introduced during that period of time, not only were we able to stay out of bankruptcy, we were able to pay off $36 million in internal loans. We've now built up a reserve to $20 million. And it's always the case of, did you leave this place better than you left it? So I can say, as of last week, Fitch Reporting Agency, Credit Reporting Agency, elevated Fresno's credit rating to an A. We were down five, six, 7 years ago down to junk bond status. And in the report itself, it says, in part due to financial policies adopted by the city that I wrote, I made a difference. I came and wrote policies, debt policies, and other fiscal policies that provided a foundation for the city, for future city councils, future mayors, that the city would never again get itself in the situation that we got ourselves into in 2009. And that's what leadership's all about.
One thing that I haven't heard talked about a lot lately, it was a huge issue back when you first came on the council, and that was the issue of the police auditor.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that the last administration debated back and forth with the council. It was in the budget. It was out of the budget. The police chief weighing in on different sides and how exactly that position was going to be crafted, what sort of powers were going to be set aside for the Office of Independent Review. That's something that was controversial also at the time, and it was a significant cost as well to add that to the city's budget. How satisfied are you with the way that's working out and with the cost that's associated? Because I've heard some people say this really isn't an independent review of a particular controversial action. We've seen some officer-involved shootings recently that have gained a lot of attention. The independent auditor isn't going to do his own investigation into those incidents. He's going to rather look at the complaints that are filed against the police department and see if those complaints are justified or not. How satisfied are you with that police auditor?
Well, the history was in the previous administration, they had tried to bring this forward. So it's something that's been around for 10 years before that. In the first year I was there with Mayor Swearingen coming in, there was a lot of pressure from the POA and to not do it.
The police union.
And I made a decision that I thought the model we came up with more limited investigative power, subpoena power, was more of a compromise to recognize that police officers have a lot of scrutiny, have a very, very difficult job. There's an internal investigation done in everything. And particularly nowadays when it's been so politicized, being a police officer, everything is second-guessed. You're the enemy, not the friend. So things have been twisted upside down. I think this model has served the city well. I think the current guy is doing a good job. Does provide a arm's length transaction. There's an independent agency over the years, some good recommendations that came out of it. Certain people will probably always want more, but I think what we have now is a very workable situation. It provides a degree of independence, and other changes like body cameras and an aggressive effort by our new district attorney to follow up on things. I think, at least at this point in time, I'm comfortable with what we have now, the model we're using.
Do you think Chief Dyer and the police department should release the body camera footage from the most recent officer-involved shooting where two officers shot and killed a young man on Clovis Avenue?
Once the investigation is complete, and out of respect for the privacy of the family, they should release it. It's got to be done at the appropriate time. You can't come out early and second-guess things. We saw clearly in cases across the country, like in Ferguson, where eyewitness accounts, once they were investigated by the Justice Department, they had one guy, I was right there, I saw this and saw that. And later on revealed he was only talking about a secondhand he had heard from somebody else. So I think when this comes out at the right time, people can judge themselves. But I think this illustrates to me the need to have a body cam, to have, an independent eye to look at what really happened, because we're all human beings and everybody sees things from a different perspective. You could have 10 eyewitnesses and have 10 different accounts sometimes on what really happened.
Lee Brand is running for Fresno mayor. He joins us today on Valley Edition. His opponent in the November election is Henry Perea, a former Fresno City Council member and a current county supervisor. Henry voted for the construction of the baseball stadium downtown, now
yes,
known as Chuck Chancey Park. That is an issue that every administration since then has had to deal with, and specifically the lease and the status of the team's ownership. There's a lot of discussion now as this continues to be a problem. The team's finances aren't the best. I think that even the Grizzlies ownership will tell you that. It has been a money-losing venture, but they are continuing to draw crowds there at Chuck Chancey Park. Still, the issue of the stadium lease is a big one, and I'm sure it's going to come up in this campaign. If you were on the council in 1998, 1999, 2000, when that stadium was being debated back and forth. Jim Patterson was the mayor, strongly against it. What would you have done? What would have the solution been to make that stadium work?
Well, the problem wasn't the stadium. The problem was the deal. It started out, you give us a land. At the time, the land they gave was from the RDA. That was land that was not worth a lot of money. And we'll give you the land, you build the stadium. And somehow it escalated from we build the stadium to the city build the stadium, and a $25 million stadium became a $46 million Cadillac version of the stadium. It was all done wrong. The negotiations were done wrong. That could have been done. Had I been in that council, it would have been what I did on my recent Economic Expansion Act. They would have been building the stadium. They would have taken out the bond to finance the stadium. The city could have offered them, you know, incentives like we'll waive the development impact fees. We'll make some off-site improvements, which they did anyway. They spent $1.8 million after the stadium was built on off-site improvements for the stadium. And we could have said, we'll give you some performance-based incentives. We'll give you a break on parking. We'll give you a break on sales tax. That's how it should have been done. The burden should have been placed on the team itself. And what you would have saw, you could have built a stadium instead of being 12,000 capacity, maybe being 8,000, which still would have met AAA standards. You could always add the box seats later. It's like Bulldog Stadium. When they built that, you can build for expansion. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to spend $1 million on a sliding stage. They went way too far. The bond debt would have been probably half what it is right now, and the working model would have been easier. By the time I came in 2009, the team was owed the city over $1 million. The scoreboard hadn't worked for 3 years. The condition of the stadium, the seats, the plumbing, it was in deplorable condition. And they came to the city saying, we need help. We're losing money too fast. And they were paying $1.5 million. And nobody at the time had ever did a study of the leases on AAA baseball, because we did one in 2009 when I was part of a negotiating committee. And the average lease back then was about $200,000 or $300,000 a year. We were at 1.5. Obviously, nobody's going to make it at 1.5. What people fail to realize in running a baseball team, there's more than simply just, you know, turning the lights on, selling the hot dogs, and, you know, paying your utility bill. It's very expensive. You got to pay when an opposing team comes in. You got to pay all their hotel bills, all their food. You have major travel costs when you fly around the country playing different games. It's a very expensive sport. And I think there was a lot of failure to verify information. And what we had the choice in 2009 is two choices, an empty stadium or get half rent. I mean, I can go and spend 2 hours beyond that, but it's that simple. So in this campaign, Henry said, oh, they made a leave. He caved under pressure. He should have left the rent at 1.5. I can tell you with 100% certainty, had that been made, you'd look at a vacant stadium right now. Because for 3 or 4 years, they've been trying to sell a team at a rent that's less than $750,000, and there's no takers so far. And there's been no takers because even getting a $1 million naming rights deal, which that was not even presumed at the time this deal was made, the team has averaged a $1 million plus loss every single year, including a $1 million naming rights. So why would somebody want to double the rent and lose $2 million? It makes no sense at all. And it's irresponsible to make those kind of statements when the team's actually trying to find a buyer that, you know, can be a viable buyer, because the stadium's a beautiful stadium. We now, whether it was a mistake or not, it's there. We need to make the best of it.
Before we go, Lee, any chance that Fresno is going to get Southwest Airlines?
That would be my hope. I mean, we made the message clear to the airport manager, Kevin, that we need to offer incentives. And I think that's a major component of bringing business to Fresno is our connections with airlines. That's the first thing people look at. And when it's convenient, for example, we have a flight from Seattle to Fresno. People like Nordstrom take attention to that.
Lee Branda joining us today, Fresno City Council member and current mayoral candidate facing off against Henry Perea in November. Lee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about a new study about farm labor here in Central California and some new insights into the immigration issue that's coming up next on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's no secret here in Central California that many, if not most, of the people who work in the fields in Valley agriculture are undocumented immigrants. There is a new study out, though, now about so-called ghost workers, common in migrant farm labor, and its author joins us now, Sarah Horton. Welcome to Valley Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sarah, let's start out with just the title here, ghost worker. What are we talking about when we talk about a ghost worker?
Right. So in doing interviews with farm workers in Central California, I heard workers discussing this category. They referred to them as trabajando fantasma, or working as a ghost. And these were individuals who were intentionally given the documents, work authorization documents of third parties to work by their foremen. So they were essentially coercively working loaned documents.
So you're saying they're given them by their foremen. Are they seeking these out? Is this a part of the employment process to become involved in? How does that work? Walk us through the process.
Yeah. So basically, what I found is that in some cases, foremen are actually, they want to, in fact, hide the identities of some of their workers, either because they are undocumented or because they are minors, and so therefore legally ineligible to work more than 8 hours a day or 48 hours a week in California. And in some cases, even because the companies appear to have an unofficial policy of evading overtime laws. So in these cases, foremen are loaning out documents to workers so that they will not appear on the books to be working overtime. So these are cases in which foremen actually are intentionally engaging in what I call identity masking. They are masking the identities of their workers in order to evade immigration and labor laws, really.
So who are these foremen? Are they labor contractors? Are they the growers themselves? Who do they represent?
Right. They're mostly the immediate labor supervisors. So in some cases, they're acting on their own accord. So, for example, in cases of labor shortage, a labor supervisor needs to fill his team. And so if he is getting, asking a miner to work, for example, he will give that miner loan documents. In other cases, it appears to be a policy among some companies to require that their foremen mask the identities of workers in order to evade overtime laws. So I've heard about this, for example, with companies that in which the mayordomos or foremen sort of universally give workers other documents to work on Sundays so that the company doesn't have to actually pay overtime laws. It appears on the books that this particular worker only worked 6 days rather than 7 days a week, and so it actually benefits the company.
So I want to emphasize here, I think it's, again, somewhat common knowledge that in this part of California, many of the workers in the fields are undocumented and in some cases have paperwork that is not necessarily legitimate, and that paperwork is presented to a grower or to a contractor. You're saying here, what's new here is that this is actually being supplied by someone they're working for and not being obtained by the worker themselves?
That's exactly right. So it's, yes. So it kind of is a little bit of the reverse of what we see in the media a lot in terms of the concern about sort of identity theft, because in this case, it is the foremen who are actually supplying workers with the loaned documents of other individuals. Exactly.
Where do they get these Social Security numbers?
From what I understand, when foremen are doing this, they typically get them from friends and family. At least that's workers' understanding of the situation, that these are friends and family of foremen who want their Social Security numbers to actually be worked, because in the process, these workers are actually sinking money into their into the retirement and unemployment accounts of these third parties. So it's actually benefiting these third parties who are, in a sense, farming out their documents to be worked. Hugh Foreman.
Sarah Horton's new study is out in the Anthropology of Work Review, and it's talking about this issue of farm labor and illegitimate documents that are supplied in some cases by a foreman for labor contractors or growers. You also, in your report, talk about some of the other problems that this can create, including for workers who might get injured on the job.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Exactly. So one of the main concerns that really arose for the workers whose identities were being masked, who were sort of forcibly working as ghosts, was that if they were injured on the job, there was no official report of their ever having been company employees. So ingeniously, the strategy of loaning out documents also makes workers disappear from the official roster of employees. And so many of these workers were terrified of actually filing a workers' compensation claim because they knew that the company could say, look, you were working someone else's documents. And they could blame the worker, even though it was the foreman who, in fact, gave them the documents.
So tell us a little more about your research. Who did you talk to in this? Did you talk to the workers? Did you talk to the growers? Did you talk to the foreman? How did the process go?
Right. So I've been working in the Valley since 2005, and I've been working with eight of the same families I've known since 2005. So I established rapport with them over time, and they were the ones who really first began talking about this practice. So then I supplemented those interviews with 37 other workers, really about how they find their work authorization documents, and also with six labor supervisors. And then finally, to make sure that this wasn't just happening sort of, you know, in a random place in the Valley, I also did interviews with eight workers' compensation attorneys on the Central Coast and down in Bakersfield to make sure that this was actually a practice that, you know, wasn't unique to Fresno County. And I heard that this was, in fact, a pretty pervasive practice for this to occur.
So is anything changing in this process? You've been following it since 2005. There are definitely some changes that have happened overall in the immigration world, more deportations, things like that. The farm labor market has seen its ebbs and flows, but there have been reports mm-hmm. of worker shortages. What's yeah. changing in your view?
Yeah. So as I understand it, I talk about this a little bit more in the book that I have coming out with University of California Press at the end of July, which is called They Leave Their Kidneys in the Fields. I mean, it's primarily about heat stroke, but I do discuss this practice of ghost workers. And what I've seen changing recently is it appears that there is more of a need for miners to work because labor supervisors need to fill their teams. So I think that there's more of a chance of this forcible identity masking to be occurring really among these miners. It's pretty routine that miners are made to work other people's documents if their family needs them to work. So that seems to be increasing. On the other hand, I think with the labor shortage, it's a little more difficult for foremen to make working other people's documents a condition of their employment because they're desperate for workers. So I'm seeing more workers being paid in cash now. And as I think the labor market becomes a little less tight, I would imagine the practice of ghost workers to increase even more.
Before we go, one last question. This issue of identity masking, ghost workers supplying one individual someone else's legal documents and assuming their identity, that would be a crime. Is there any, concern amongst those who are doing this that they could face prosecution? And is there any sort of evidence that there have been any investigations into those supplying these documents?
Right. So, and I want to just sort of say, up front here, is that, of course, this practice is not unique to farm work. So I first became aware of it in farm work, but, you know, it's pretty common in many sectors of the industry that rely on undocumented workers. So I think that's why it's an interesting case study to look at farm work. Because as far as I know, I do know of some companies that have fired foremen when they become aware of this practice. But if you look at other industries, for example, even in the raid of in Postville of the meatpacking plant there in 2008, it became after the raid and the prosecutions of undocumented workers for identity theft, It emerged that, in fact, it was several mid-level supervisors who were involved in giving many of these workers documents. So one plant manager admitted in court to attempting to buy fake documents for 19 workers. One office employee and supervisor were convicted of aggravated identity theft. So I haven't heard of prosecutions in farm work of foremen for this, but there have been, in fact, prosecutions of supervisors in other industries for this. But I think it's something that people are less aware of as, you know, the attention is being sort of caught or drawn instead to the idea of immigrant workers as identity thieves. They're missing the role of employers in this process.
Sarah Horton is an anthropologist at the University of Colorado, Denver. She has a new study out in the Anthropology of Work Review about ghost workers, farm laborers who are supplied documentation of others, essentially being the subjects of identity swapping through their foreman at their employment. This new study is going to be followed soon by a book from the University of California Press. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
This is Valley Edition. As part of our California Counts election coverage, KPCC's Mary Plummer looked into the status of women in politics here in California, and she reports their progress is mixed.
Who represents the people that can't use the parks, that can't find their way to schools, moms who have to walk their kids through some of these encampments? Who speaks for them?
The voice you're hearing is Councilwoman Nuri Martinez. Among the 15 council members representing nearly 4 million Los Angeles residents, Martinez is the only woman.
I'm embarrassed. I have no explanation. People are in shock that the second largest city in the country, we have this gender issue in Los Angeles.
When it comes to gender equity, the story around the state isn't much better. Only about 28% of city council members in California are female. California's legislature has a slightly lower rate. It ranks 21st in the country for the number of women holding office. Rachel Michelin monitors these numbers across the state. She's the executive director of the nonprofit California Women Lead and says the state is lagging when it comes to women holding public office.
We're not seeing that trend here that you might be seeing at a national level.
As for why this is happening, well, as you might guess, it's a complex problem with much research and varying opinions on the causes. But in the next few minutes, we'll take you through three contributing factors. Reason number one, fundraising challenges. Again, here's Michelin.
We don't always write checks. When you look at who contributes money to political candidates, regardless of what office they're running for, typically men will write bigger checks.
Michelin says running for LA City Council is competitive and expensive compared to many other offices in the state. Plus, women aren't in the habit of giving to campaigns like some men do, and they don't always have the spare cash to build their political clout. Female candidates play a role, too. They tend to be less experienced in fundraising. Smaller Rolodexes mean fewer people to call for contributions. Reason number two, women don't always support other women. LA Councilmember Martinez says she's faced sexism many times during more than a decade in office. She remembers seeking an endorsement from a group when she was pregnant and running for a seat on the LA school board.
A woman in the audience said to me, "You're 8 months pregnant. Aren't you better off staying home and raising your child?"
Martinez says she couldn't believe what she was hearing.
And I looked at her and I said, "Ma'am, how many male candidates have you asked that question of? How come you only ask that of women?" And she said, "Yes."
Martinez didn't get the endorsement that day, but she did win the election. Reason number three, voting psychology. Research shows that when voters don't have enough information on candidates, they rely on gender stereotypes. And that's why aspiring politicians are affected more than, say, someone well-known, like Hillary Clinton. To dig into this issue, I called up a real voter.
Hello?
This is Burbank resident Mariah Booth-Ong.
I do consider gender when I'm voting, but I'd love to not. I don't know if that makes sense.
Booth-Ong explains that she wishes the number of women in politics was on par with men and that gender was a non-issue. But research shows they're not there yet, male candidates are often favored for their perceived strengths in handling the economy, for example, while female candidates are seen as strong on issues like education. LA County voters will decide the gender balance on one influential body in November. Two female candidates are frontrunners for the LA County Board of Supervisors. If they win, LA County could become the only board in the state with 4 out of 5 female board members. Covering politics, I'm Mary Plummer.
This is Valley Edition. Fresno has many hidden gems. One of them is tucked away on Winery Avenue, not far from the Fresno airport. It's called the Discovery Center. It's a great place if you have kids or anyone really interested in science and all sorts of fascinating things, from cacti to dinosaurs. It's doing a lot of things this summer. Joining us right now from the Discovery Center to tell us about some of those summertime activities, we have Debbie Mila. She's the director of the Discovery Center. Debbie, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Every summer, the Discovery Center offers families and individuals a chance to stay for the evenings and learn about the stars above. Tell us what's going on with the star parties.
Well, on Friday nights, we have a professor from Fresno State, Professor Weimer. He comes out and brings his telescopes, and people come in and they can sit there with their lawn chairs, and he will give a little bit of a lecture. Not really a lecture, but fun information.
A talk,
thank you, about the stars and what's happening. And it happens every Friday night. Generally, they start getting there about 8 o'clock, and it all is dependent on weather, if we have clouds or not. And the most it's going to cost you is $5 a carload. You can't beat it for a Friday night.
Sounds like a great activity. Now, the Discovery Center has been around a long time in Fresno. It's gone through a lot of changes over the years. Bring us up to date on where the Discovery Center is at right now, not physically, but just in its terms of, in terms of its operations and its status with the city, with being an independent organization, et cetera.
Well, we are a 501c3, a nonprofit, and of course, that's always a struggle. But for the longest time after the fire, people thought we were closed. And we're not. We have remained open, and luckily we've been getting the word out there, so our attendance has been growing. We do classes with the schools, and that helps us to raise our money. We have our memberships. We have our admissions into the museum, and the museum is a place that is very fascinating. Everything from space to animals. So the park is a free entity, and you can come enjoy, play on the playground. You can check out some of our tortoises. We even have our cactus garden, the Deutsch Cactus Garden, which is amazing.
Yeah, tell us some more about that. I went on a tour of that just a few weeks ago, and it's really impressive. I didn't think there was even something like that in the Fresno area. I've grown up and lived in this area my whole life. I didn't realize that there was such an amazing cactus garden here in the valley.
Well, 25 years ago, Fred Deutsch passed away and left his cactus garden, which was in his backyard, to the county. Long story short, it was given to the city, and the city was looking for a place to put it. And so the Discovery Center got it. So that place has been in there for 25 years. Cactus galore. We have, oh boy, things that bloom that I never knew would bloom. And it's just a beautiful walk. We are in the process. Unfortunately, we've had lots of rain to bring lots of weeds. So we're in the process of pulling all the weeds now.
Getting it nice and pretty, and it's looking great. Now, are you affiliated with the Garden of the Sun next door? Is that part of the Discovery Center? The UC Master Gardeners do a great job there. Is that part of your organization?
No, we're actually separate. They are on the same property. We partner with them on a couple different things, but they have their beautiful garden. They run their own classes. And then once in a while, we're working to partner with them for some future classes with our garden.
So you have some other events that also are coming up, Saturday Science Craft Weekends. What takes place in something like a craft weekend or a Saturday Science event? What are those about?
Well, the crafts are dependent on what's going on. Generally, if it's Father's Day, we do something for Father's Day. 4th of July, we do something for 4th of July. But with your paid admission into the museum, each kid gets to come in and make a craft. Our Saturday science, excuse me, our Saturday science consists of instructors coming in and teaching about a half-hour class to the kids. They get to do a hands-on activity and sometimes even make more crafts.
Well, it's very exciting. If people want more information about the Discovery Center, want to get involved or simply go to an event, what can they do? How can they learn more information?
Well, our Facebook is the best way. It's Discovery Center Fresno, or our website is thediscoverycenter.net. And please visit it and visit our center, because there's a lot happening and we're doing a lot of growing right now.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're on a good path. The city has gone through its ups and downs, and we saw Rotary Storyland and Playland sort of take off in their own direction as independent organizations. You're kind of doing the same thing now.
We are. We figured it's our turn. This is a hidden gem that everybody has forgotten about, thought we were closed, and money hasn't been the best, but we are working on revamping. We're revamping the front just to make it look better, our playground area, all kinds of things. So we're looking for corporate sponsors to help us, too.
And it's important to have a place that kids can go locally for science. We don't have the Metropolitan Museum anymore.
Right. And we're not just science. Pretty much everything is science, but we never want anybody to be scared off by science. So we just say it's a roundabout educational area.
It's a great asset for the community. Debbie Mila, the director of the Discovery Center, joining us today. Debbie, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email. We are talk@kvpr.org. And also send us a tweet @kvpr and @Valley Edition. You can find our podcasts and audio archives online at kvpr.org as well. Find other pieces by our reporters and local news throughout the week. Our stories also air on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, so we hope you'll tune in there as well. And our ongoing election coverage, it is an election year, 2016, and you can find all those stories on our website, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.